Yeah. Okay. A genuine treaty of peace is different than a temporary cessation of hostilities. When you enter into a peace treaty with a country that you've been at war with, what you're saying is, Kant tells us, you are putting aside the grounds of conflict. You are saying that we are not going to go to war again. We are putting an end to the war by putting an end to the causes of the war. Whatever the object of dispute is, we're going to come up with a settlement that both sides can be happy with, and therefore set aside the grounds of aggression. Now, Kant recognizes that often peace treaties don't work that way. Often peace treaties, although he doesn't quite say this, the implication is often peace treaties are imposed by the victor on the vanquished. And when peace treaties are imposed by the victor on the vanquished, then of course they're imposed unilaterally on terms favorable to the victor. And when that happens, of course, the causes of war are not dissolved. They continue. And this is what Kant means by saying there is tacitly reserved a matter for future war. Now, a classic example of this happened way after Kant's death. And that, and what I'm talking about here is the Versailles Treaty that put an end to the First World War. Now, because there you did not have an agreement on the part of both sides to set aside the grounds of conflict. What happened was the Versailles Treaty imposed peace conditions on Germany, which were very onerous. You know, they included so-called reparations, in which a good percentage of German tax dollars went to the victors of that war. They included a prohibition against rearming in any significant sense, so Germany was kept from having a military that could defend it, and so on. And that created, of course, great resentment on the part of the Germans, a great sense of national humiliation, and we've talked about this before. And this was in part the political background to the rise of the Nazi Party.
I think most importantly, the German army may have been mutinous, but they regarded themselves as anything but defeated. Many of the soldiers in the German army went on to continue fighting on their home turf, and they never really disbanded.
Well, then they became the so-called Freikorps, especially on their home turf.
And if you have, you know, a generation of children whose parents have been massacred and their only models are Freikorps.
Right. The Freikorps were the earliest version, the pre-Nazi version of what was later to become the stormtroopers and the SS. These were units, they were sort of death squads that were cobbled together from veterans of the First World War and were sent against really mostly the political left at that point. The anti-Semitic pogroms were yet to happen. They really waited until Hitler's rise to power. But they were the beginnings of what would later become Nazism. You're absolutely right. Okay, so if you want peace, don't do Versailles. It's basically what Kant has said, right? It seems reasonable. Yeah. Let's take a look at the second preliminary article. It's really a little bit anachronistic. What it says here is that no independent states, large or small, shall come under the dominion of another state by inheritance, exchange, purchase, or donation. What the hell is he talking about? How does one state come under the dominion or the power of another by inheritance, exchange, purchase, or donation? What's he talking about?
Maybe financial trouble. One state offers to pay off another state's debt if it allows them to rule over them. Or
Can you think of a case where that happened?
I can't think of one personally.
Well, the expansion of Rome.
What Kant really has in mind here is a practice that was pretty much limited to the Middle Ages and the absolute monarchies that followed the Middle Ages. You acquire a kingdom, for example, by marrying a monarch who possesses that kingdom. The King of England marries French princess, right?
Cleopatra.
Yeah, I think I don't think where Egypt comes under the control of Mark Antony. But they never married, did they? Or did they?
It wasn't official in
Roman. Yeah, yeah. I don't think they quite pulled that off. They may have had it in mind. But, you know, Eleanor of Aquitaine brings the French province of Aquitaine under the rule of the King of England when she marries Henry. That kind of thing. And what Kant says here is, I think, instructive. What he says here is that nations are not simply pieces of property. In other words, nations are, in Kant's view, moral persons. See, we still have this category in American law. You know, a collective, like a corporation, for example, can have personal status. It's a legal entity, right? They can be. Well, here what Kant is saying is that a nation, a country, is a place where people have agreed on a political contract, a social contract that's created a government that protects the liberties of the citizens. So to think that that could be acquired by, as though it were a piece of somebody's dowry, or something that could be bought or sold, is treating persons as things. And of course, that's excluded by the categorical imperative. You know, nations are moral persons and not things. Yeah?
Does this include military annexation or just sovereign exchanges by monarchs and governments?
Well, I think Kant would say that military annexation is also such a case. It's a case in which the desire of a people to be governed by a government of their own choosing is being abrogated in favor of whatever motives are behind the annexation. Now Kant doesn't quite say that it's never legitimate to do this, but what he does say is that if we want to move in the direction of perpetual peace, we have to stop doing it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's some places where the cultures are you know, just because it's a point of conflict, are very similar. Like Alsace, it could be equally German as it is French.
Yeah.
But the Südtirol is distinctly, you know, Austrian.
Yeah.
And it's been an Italian possession since the First World War.
Yeah. And there are all kinds of issues that would have to be hashed out around this. But we don't yet have the framework in place to do it at this stage in perpetual peace. Yeah.
But doesn't Kant say in here that even we treat our armies as the personnel of our armies as objects?
Yeah. And here, I think it's interesting because the third principle, preliminary article, the third preliminary article seems to be completely utopian. It seems to be utterly radical. And what Kant says here is that standing armies shall in time be finally abolished. Now, let's you know, why? Well, let's take a look. Let's see what he says. He says, "For they incessantly menace other states by their readiness to appear at all times prepared for war. They incite them to compete with each other in the number of armed men, and there is no limit to this. For this reason, the cost of peace finally becomes more oppressive than that of a short war, and consequently a standing army is itself a cause of offensive war waged in order to relieve the state of this burden." He's writing in the 19th century here, remember. I mean, on the 18th century here. It's a little bit different than the current period. And here is the, "Add to this that to pay men to kill or be killed seems to entail using them as mere machines and tools in the hands of another," and in parentheses, the state, "and this is hardly compatible with the rights of mankind in our own person." Remember the second formulation of the categorical imperative? Treat humanity, whether in your own person or that of another, always as an end and never as a means merely. Right? To treat humanity in the person of another as a means merely is simply to use them to achieve some external purpose. And here what's being said is that the soldiers on one's own side are being used that way.
You only mentioned a standing army. What if, for example, can you have a military where you have maybe supposedly trained normal civilians that can be called up at a moment's notice if they need help?
Have you read the next sentence?
No.
He says here, But the periodic and voluntary military exercises of citizens who thereby secure themselves and their country against foreign aggression are entirely different.
I guess that answers that question.
Yeah, that answers your question. In other words, what Kant is recommending here is the end to professionalized standing armies and their replacement with citizen militias.
Okay.
There's an example of this. You know, the Swiss Army is more or less organized along the lines of a civilian militia. Maybe this is responsible for Switzerland's decision to remain neutral in most wars. You know, maybe they realized that should they go to war, they'd have the crap kicked out of them. I don't know. It's hard to imagine modern war, you know, war in the 20th century and 21st century is being fought simply with citizen militias. But there may be an analog of what Kant is recommending, even today. There are some peace advocates who advocate not disarmament, but the replacement of aggressive armaments and aggressive military organization with defensive armaments and defensive military organization.
Like, what's an example of a defensive military organization?
Well, presumably, for example, a defensive military organization would not involve, you know, bases around the world. It would involve, you know, a pullback to one's own borders, or to nearly a pullback to one's own borders. But I'm no expert in this, but they've actually gone through lists of military equipment and sort of sifted out the equipment that only makes sense as used offensively from equipment that is essentially defensive in character. You could imagine if it weren't technologically absurd. You could think that the Reagan-era Star Wars shield might be such a thing.
Right.
But the problem with Star Wars is that the Star Wars shield was a missile defense system that would sort of automatically identify and shoot down nuclear weapons headed toward the states. But the problem is that when you have sides that are armed with nuclear weapons, then any impregnable defense becomes interpreted as offensive by the other side.
Right.
Because now you can launch
and
not worry about the consequences.
Okay.
There's no doubt that there's a much more complicated situation than when Kant himself was around. But it's not immediately evident that what's behind this desire to abolish standing armies is completely insane.
I'll read an example of a defensive position within his own terms, basically just building forts within your own borders. Could that be entailed as defensive?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Yeah, and as I said, in the 18th century, I think it was a lot easier to distinguish between defensive and offensive formations. Okay. But you notice, if it were true, I mean, the reason why this is sort of odd to think of as a preliminary article is that if it were the case that standing armies were abolished around the world and replaced with citizen militias, it would seem to me that perpetual peace would be achieved by that very measure. In other words, it would no longer be preliminary to the achievement of perpetual peace. It would be the definitive achievement of perpetual peace. Unless you conceive of citizen militias as being a great... I guess you could. I guess if there were no standing armies around, you know, in the world, citizen militias could still engage in aggressive warfare. Yeah?
I think our standing armies today are nuclear defenses.
Yeah.
I think our nuclear defenses can be seen as too powerful and as an offensive. But creating a nuclear defense is essentially an offensive move.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So I think we have to abolish the nuclear stages of things, and then we'd be all right with our standing armies.
Actually, I think it's the opposite. Can I go up there for a second?
Sure. You have chalk? You got to bring your own.
Actually, there is. If I may. Now, what we see here is a very crude map of the Middle East here. Jerusalem, here's Cairo, here's Alexandria. Now I wanted you to all consider something for a moment. There's only, at the moment, one nuclear power in the Middle East, and that is, of course, Israel.
Pakistan.
Pakistan isn't in the Middle East. It's part of the Indian subcontinent.
Well, Israel's technically in Asia Minor.
Of course, we don't have these fine distinctions. Either way, you know, Pakistan is the sole Islamic bomb, and, you know, what we see here, nuclear powers represent a sort of a global elite.
Right.
Any nuclear power has to remain at peace with other nuclear powers, at least on the surface. We can only battle each other through auxiliaries, through terrorists, through things like Vietnam. You know, we can't actually kill each other. If the nuclear elite is extended to include other countries, well, you know, a lot of people would say that, well, the Islamic bomb could just blow up Jerusalem, right? You know, there could be total war everywhere, chaos. But I don't think that's likely. No Sunni or Shia would want to destroy Jerusalem. You know, for the first 6 years of the Prophethood of Muhammad, Muslims bowed to Jerusalem, not to the Kaaba and Mecca.
I think the worry is not so much governments launching these weapons. The worry is fringe organizations getting their hands on these weapons. And the worry is that since some of the organizations are not nearly as stable as the West, there's a worry of security.
Well, my thought is that if nuclear powers are cultivated in the stable governments within each geopolitical zone, that those governments will be forced to remain at peace with each other and stabilize the rest of their zones for fear of it sparking an international conflict. For example, Egypt is happy right now to, you know, implicitly or tacitly endorse terrorism in Israel. You know, Lebanon is happy.
Well, the reason why they don't want nuclear to expand because they don't want countries, you know, what about every country has nuclear, so they don't want nuclear to fall in one hand, so like the terrorists, so.
But if you expand nuclear, it might be a possibility to block nuclear coming in and still expel nuclear power. But it would still advance.
You mean like Star Wars, that one country could still cancel out other countries' nuclear authority and
right, so that's the best thing to do would just be get rid of nuclear altogether.
Oh, then actually.
But you can't. It's too late. We can't get rid of it. We can minimize it. We can cut it back. But you can't get rid of nuclear authority at this point, and it wouldn't be prudent to. It's the one thing which prevents the first world from destroying each other. And it's also the one thing which empowers the first world over the third world. You know, you look at neocolonialism. What is money really? It's imaginary. It's imaginary. What are the $700 billion we spent to bail out Wall Street? Can you count $700 billion bills? They don't exist in the world. They're just strings, you know, for puppets. It's the bombs. The bombs are what hold it all in place.
Now, are you beginning to appreciate how difficult teaching is?
one question for you.
Yes.
What about the widespread belief that, in the case of one nuclear stand off, Pakistan and India, mutually assured destruction isn't true? But neither country has good enough controls over their nuclear launch procedures to necessarily be able to launch a counterattack in time. And they're pretty sure that Pakistan can't, that if India fired nuclear bombs on Pakistan, that Pakistan couldn't get their weapons in the air in time to destroy India.
Actually,
India could start a nuclear war and win.
That's a very good point, and as a matter of fact, not just India could start a nuclear war and win, but very easily Pakistan's nuclear power could be usurped. You know, it's not a stable country. And it would be entirely possible, you know, that they've been so much fighting there for the last couple of years. Nobody really knows where the bombs are.
That's true, but it would give terrorists access to fissionable materials, which is kind of scary. But fissionable materials, I mean, just bombs by themselves are useless. You need to know how to fire them.
That's true.
So they have fissionable materials, which they could conceivably use to make new bombs.
Or dirty bombs.
Or dirty bombs. But it's not that easy. And I think there would be a lot of people looking for them at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But And India and Pakistan are pretty advanced nations compared to most of the...
Yes, and you see, here's the thing. If it's only two nuclear powers in a region challenging each other, it's still possible for them to blow each other up. If there's multiple nuclear powers representing different blocks within a geopolitical region or continent, then if there's enough of them, they cancel each other out. For example, I wouldn't trust, say, just Egypt or Lebanon not to try and, you know, pull something sneaky. But if there's enough different nuclear powers in the area, they can't feasibly do anything anymore.
So you're suggesting we hand every strong political government nuclear power?
I'm suggesting we cultivate nuclear powers.
Is there a single strong government in the Middle East?
I think Cairo has a strong government. I think that Damascus has a somewhat strong government. Saudi Arabia will have a strong government until their oil money runs out, and then I don't think that
the revolution comes.
James, I'm just going to say one thing. I am not fee splitting with you. You get none of my salary.
I got this idea from you. I know.
And I have to fess up. I got it from a British historian who whose name is, what's his name? Oh, I'm blanking at it at the moment. Perry Anderson. Yeah, Perry Anderson wrote a piece just prior to the invasion of Iraq, or maybe it was just after the invasion of Iraq, where he argued that were he a non-nuclear nation looking at that event, the motive for acquiring nuclear weapons would become overwhelming. Because notice, Korea was not invaded.
Yes.
Korea was a part of George Bush's axis of evil, right?
Well, they had the artillery pointed right at Seoul, so if they try anything within the first 30 minutes, they'll blow the South Koreans to hell.
And there are nuclear power. So,
exactly.
In fact, what the point that Anderson made was that the nuclear powers prior in the aftermath of World War II have not gone to war with one another, and it does seem as though they said
that's yeah. right. But you see, the thing is, it is of much more danger to everyone if rogue nations can home grow nuclear weapons than...
So it's better to regulate them. Well, if an international nuclear agency, the purpose of which will be to arm everybody.
Yes!
It sounds good to me.
Everybody is that you have all the...
Okay. So, James, thank you very much. Excellent job. Sit down. We're going to watch at the very end here. No, just keep in your seats. We're going to watch Feather Boas. Oh, I've got to plug my sound in, too. Hold on. Let's see here. I'll do it again. Let's see here. Give me one second. Where am I here? Here we go. You make sure we've got sound. All right. We do this, and we do this. And where is... Did I screw this up? Ah.
This is the problem.
time will be the definitive articles.
Was that one person that was filming all that?
Yeah, one person.